I'm Kevin Davis, and this is the Catholic Family Podcast. And our good friend, Mr. Ruby over here, I got to switch. I'm always on the other side. Sorry about that, guys. There we go. I don't know if that's better or worse, but Mr. Ruby's over here. We're talking about state of econtism. We've already had three pieces up, four. Part one, part two, part three, part three and a half, and now part four, talking about state of econtism and, well, Mr. Ruby's theories about, I guess, the whole situation. I mean, it's kind of complex. It's kind of hard for me to even introduce because it's the whole concept is pretty intense, pretty difficult. But I do think that he's done a very good job of breaking it down. And it's a very interesting theory that you don't really hear out there, and that many people just poo-poo with it and just call it quote-unquote garbage theology. And they don't even really listen to it. And I think that's absolutely a fact. They won't actually listen to the theory. So anyone who's interested, please hear Mr. Ruby out. He's going to tell you his theory. And again, as I've said in previous podcasts, this is not necessarily a theory that I agree with. Some things I do, some things I don't. That's okay. It's a theory. We can all agree, disagree. This is trying to find a solution. This is not talking dogma. He's not telling us what we have to believe. Keep that in mind. Now, please listen to him. Hear him out. He's trying to honestly find solutions here. And I think he's got some really good points. So, Mr. Ruby, please run away with it.
Very well. Okay. Well, so when we're talking about, when I say a theory, theory is still pretty strong. I think I should distinguish between a theory versus a hypothesis. And I kind of have a third category I would call a scenario. It's like a hypothesis, but it's rather so crudely formed that it would be difficult to figure out how to even test it. Hypothesis, this is from science. In a hypothesis, you are positing that you think such and such is the case, and now you're going to do something, or a scientific experiment or something that will either show that your hypothesis is correct or else show that nope, wrong idea, back to the drawing board kind of a thing. And if the experiment shows that the hypothesis is consistent with the result, then you kind of say, then maybe there's more of this hypothesis than just an idea being thrown out there. Maybe there could be something to it. It graduates to the status of what's called a theory. Now, theories can still be disproven. They could not work out sometimes, and sometimes they do. This is the world of science, and theology is a science every bit as much as physics or chemistry. Actually, if anything, it's more akin to that of mathematics, because there's really not much in the way of experiments that you can do in theology. It's really based heavily on scholarship. If something is proven, that proof can imply other things as being true, even as in mathematics, you prove a particular theorem, that implies other theorems that can be based on that would also be true if you could just prove from the one that the other is also true, and so on. And that's how our theological understanding grows as we mature in our understanding of the faith that was given to us originally. It does not change it. It certainly does not contradict anything we've learned. But what it will do is provide answers to subtle questions that may not have been thought of, or may have been, you know, ventured very, very hesitantly, one way or another in times past, and clearly where the church had no stand on a question one way or the other, because there are many areas of legitimate theological, differences of opinion. Now, there's, of course, any number of historical areas that are well established, but our whole situation we're in now has, of course, introduced some new areas of doubt, and we're trying to understand what's going on. So when I say I've got a theory, it's got, you know, it is a theory. It's only a theory. You know, Cassiciacum is a theory. And, at some point or another, I think it had a fair amount going for it. At some other point, we could talk about that, but I'm not going to go into that now. But, there's not very, very many scenarios I will dignify with the word theory. I will at least dignify that one with that particular limited but genuine praise. It was a theory. And this is a theory. And what is the theory based on? Okay, we are starting with an obvious observation here that we have seen what appeared to be the church just decaying, right? We all saw it. Now, imagine you're in 16th century England and you don't understand that there's a schism that has gone on, that your priests and your bishops actually signed a document on a given day that basically said they are, their supreme spiritual authority is only the king or queen, as the case may be at various times, and not the Pope in Rome. Now, when they signed that, was that a heresy? Depends how you take it. If you're saying the Pope has no business ruling the church, yeah, that would be a heresy. But it's not clear that they meant that, for England was perfectly content to let the rest of the world of Christianity, you know, take the Pope as their supreme head. They were perfectly content with that. It's just, we here in England, our supreme authority is our king, because we don't like to be ruled by foreign potentates, you know, over us. That shouldn't, that was their thing. It was a very political, nationalistic view that said, we don't like the idea of some foreign prince, you know, telling us anything as if they're an authority over us. So they said, so we'll just have our king, and that's our supreme authority, even in spiritual matters. And when they sign that thing, they create, that's when the schism itself was actually created. But let's say we don't know any of that. We're just an ordinary parishioner, and we've been going to Father Smith's Mass since we were, you know, he baptized us as babies, and he's still there, this venerable old priest, only he's modernizing his Mass. He smashed his altar and smashed his, stained glass windows, and even took pieces of the altar and uses it to, you know, turn into stepping stones so we can all step on them on the way into the church, and all these other things that went on. Dear old Father Smith is doing all this thing. And well, what's the matter? Is it just Father Smith is all messed up? Well, we write to his bishop. Oh no, Father Smith is doing what we want him to do. He's doing what he's supposed to do. And well, what's wrong with you, Bishop? No, hey, nothing's wrong. You know, we're wondering, how can this be? Imagine what our theology of the church must be going through. We thought the church was indefectible. We thought that, you know, it was an infallible guide and teacher. And now we're finding all this weirdness going on. And maybe we start having to stretch in an elastic manner idea of what's possible and the things that were just, we would never have accepted before. You know, can you imagine that mental process? Well, isn't that what everybody's gone through now? Because that's, if you don't know, the one key thing that made that possible was that they schismatically separated themselves from the church. They were a branch of the tree, the church in England, and then somebody took an action, just went chop, and now suddenly you've just got this branch. You know, either it falls to the ground, or you could put metal straps to kind of sort of hold it in place, but not well enough to really graft it back on, you know, and it may sit there physically, but the fact of the matter is, it is no longer connected to the tree. It is no longer deriving its life, its sap, and so forth from the roots of the tree. It's just this branch, which for the moment still looks fine, but as we know, the leaves will turn brown, they'll die and turn brittle and start falling off, and the whole branch starts drying up because it is not connected to the tree. And so all these things that we do to protect our church in terms of, like, we have a bishop isn't just by himself as he would have been, say, in the first century. He'd have a whole army of different, you know, minor officials and so forth in his office in charge of different things and so forth to run an effective episcopacy. And that's how that would have been. And all that has not provided any protection. You see, unless that bishop is connected to the church, gaining his spiritual life from the church. So there had to have been a break somewhere. I posit that there is. I look for it, and I believe I have found it. That's where my theory comes in. Now, one other thing. Most of the breaks that have happened historically, the schisms really, have involved geographical areas. I've illustrated with England. In 1054, you know, the Patriarch of Constantinople decided to excommunicate the Pope. And that, you know, instead of excommunicating the Pope, it really ended up bounding back on him and excommunicating him instead. But it still resulted in I think, a real and valid excommunication. It just didn't excommunicate who he thought it was. But now there he is. He's cut himself off from the tree, and the East has been free to go into areas where they doubt, let's say, for example, that the Holy Ghost comes from both the Father and the Son. They say, oh, only the Father only, or I even heard the Son only, but I think that was a mistake somebody was making. But, I mean, I've heard those kinds of things, but not that, you know, the Holy Ghost proceeds from the Father and the Son. You see, I mean, that's doctrine, that's dogma, it's in the creed. But I guess you could argue it wasn't in the creed till close to that time, not because it wasn't true, but because that clarification needed to be made. It's not in the Apostles' Creed either. That doesn't mean it's not true. It just means the Apostles' Creed didn't drill into much detail. So that's a cutoff there. And every other schism, you know, you'll find some legal, official, public act that separated in all these cases some geographical area. Well, what we've had here has affected the whole world. That's, you know, it's almost like you're cutting the tree off right at the trunk where it comes up out of the ground. But you can't do that, because that would be the fall of the entire church. The fall of the church in a given region is one thing. The fall of the entire church worldwide is something more significant. It can't happen quite that way. So you have to find a particular kind of break that is different. It does not require of every person that they be severed, but it creates some kind of an invitation for anyone and everyone who basically wishes to be severed in their, you know, fallen human fleshly desire to effectively separate themselves and still be counted as being in good standing. So how do you create that? How do you come up with that? What I have found in Lumen Gentium, and I might as well give a small history, I was wondering these things too. And just the overall fall of the church. How was this happening? And my solution, I didn't have a solution. I was just kind of seeing that tradition is, you know, doing what's right and that the Novus Ordo is not. So, but how was I able to explain it then? And it was actually a Novus Ordo bishop who suggested that I read the documents of Vatican II. I wish I had my volume of that to hold it and say, which would be this book here, which I still have in another part of the house, but I'd hold it up and say, you really think I'm ready for that? Because I tried to look at it once when I first found them in a used bookstore, and it was like, I don't know what this is way, going way over my head. I can't even figure out what it's saying, let alone evaluate it in any meaningful sense. So I just closed it up, threw it on a shelf, and forgot about it. Now the bishop's saying, you should read these documents. And I think he actually recommended Lumen Gentium by name.
Interesting.
So with some hesitation, I took it down and I started reading. Now, by this point, I've kind of been around. I understand the Mass. I understand a lot about Catholic doctrine and a lot about what's, you know, makes Catholicism distinct from all the other kinds of Christianity one can think of. So I'm a lot more cognizant of all this stuff. I'm also aware of the various traditional communities that have existed, both outside their organization and those ones, you know, the Indulterian at the time inside. I'm aware of these histories. Make of it what you will. I know their histories. So I'm trying to, you know, account for all of that, to explain all of that. And I'm reading Lumen Gentium, and I hit this paragraph that just, it's the moment I read that, it was like I saw the whole thing. Not really, but I think I saw enough to realize something really important just happened right here. Something that made it basically amounted to, they are saying that their organization as a society is not to be identified in an exact and exclusive manner with the mystical body of Christ. That there is a difference. There is a separate thing. So let's look at the actual passage. Now, in my second volume, I start fairly early on diving straight into this actual passage, and I look at the grammar of it phrase by phrase, and I comment on each phrase and then the whole thing a little bit more in detail. So it comes in paragraph 8. There's kind of three parts to the 8th paragraph. There's a first part that kind of follows naturally from the first 7 paragraphs of Lumen Gentium, which so far is a fairly reasonable, almost praiseworthy description of the church, really us traditionalists, actually, if you look at it closely, because it's talking about all the fathers of the church and, you know, how they formed everything and all the poetic ways they've spoken of the church and all of that, which applies now quite specifically and exclusively to us traditionalists today. But we finally get to all of this description, and then you get up to paragraph 8. The first part kind of continues that one more bit. The middle part has the crucial stuff, and then there's a last part that kind of starts moving into other material. This middle paragraph begins with the phrase, "This church," which is to say the church that has been described so admirably and well up to that point. Okay, and it continues with it. "Constituted and organized in the world as a society." Still true. We are constituted and organized in the world as a society, even though we have a material interruption to our unity in the various particular traditional communities, but no worse than there were multiple papal claimants, maybe arguably not even as bad, because we're not claiming separate popes here, we're just claiming separate communities that have difficulty recognizing some of each other. You know, the SSPV, for example, doesn't want to recognize the CMRI, and, you know, and both are kind of funny about whether to recognize the, you know, the SSPX or other, you know, there's other traditional societies, and, you know, there's this tension and so forth. But that's not as bad as having multiple popes. But obviously, the church's material unity is somewhat interrupted. In fact, because we don't have a pope to pull them all together and say, "I'm it. This is it. You're with me or you're not part of the church." Without that, you know, it's kind of hard. It's a little like herding cats. You'd think it'd be a whole lot worse than it is, frankly. All right. So this church, constituted and organized in the world of society, subsists in. Now, even the word subsists is not wrong, because all that means is exists, but with a kind of self-contained existence. That is to say, the church is not dependent on anything in the world. Kind of reflects back to us being a perfect society. The church stands on its own. But it's this little word "in." This "in," we'll talk a little more about this as it goes. That changes everything. Okay, so we talk about that some more. All right, it says the Catholic Church. I note that it did not capitalize Catholic. You know, when we talk about the Catholic Church, we always capitalize it because we know which one we're talking about, the one that, you know, is led by Peter and by all the popes from the very beginning, you know, Christ and so forth. And now suddenly here it isn't. I don't know. That may or may not mean anything. It also did not specify Roman Church, another point brought out by another writer I'll be quoting shortly. So it's just calling it's more like a Catholic Church, so to speak, which is not to be confused with the Catholic Church, which we are, which is the mystical body. Suddenly you have a Catholic Church, and it's just governed by the successor of Peter and by the bishops in communion with him. Well, this is kind of a strange part. The true church, of course, would be governed by Peter, you know, and will be again anytime we should have a Peter, and the bishops in communion with him, who basically traditional bishops are by their very nature and definition, really, it's a tautology, are in communion with the chair of Peter, even when vacant. You know, if they weren't, what are we doing here, right? Okay, of course they are, but that's a tautology by definition. And then it goes on. But it could also be naming these people, and I believe it does, as the initial charter members of this new pseudo so-called Catholic Church that's not the Catholic Church, but really another Catholic Church that they are now defining into existence. And it goes on to say, although many elements of sanctification and truth are found outside of its visible structure. Now, when you have that, what they've done is they've made it explicit. You know, the subsists already makes it explicit. There is not an absolute identity implied. But now they're actually going so far as to make it clear that some of that subsisting church is clearly outside, it says outside the confines is the actual phrase in the passage, of their society, which is to say, not answerable de jure to the Vatican society or its leaders. So that's what that's saying. They did this with the idea that this would enable them to say that other churches and so forth are also part of the church, also parts of the mystical body of Christ. That's nonsense. And indeed, in Mystici Corporei, promulgated by Pope Pius XII, it's quite explicit. The identification between the Catholic Church and the mystical body of Christ is absolute, exclusive. One is the other is the one. So it is absolute identity. That has to remain true because that is dogma. But now they are describing a Catholic Church within which, and in fact, really not even necessarily the entirety of which, some portion and not all of this real Catholic Church subsists. What it really amounts to is you've got two societies. When you have two societies and they've made themselves now charter members of this new society, whatever they might have been in the past as Pope and bishops is kind of up to their ability to basically serve in two separate offices in two separate societies. Can they do this? Maybe for a while, sometimes. It's a little like having two masters. If everything the two masters always wanted of you was exactly the same thing, you could probably get on reasonably well having two masters. But as we know, when you've got two masters, it's not long before one wants you to do shine his shoes while the other one wants you to do the dishes, and you can't do both at the same time, and you now have to choose one master or the other. You've got two now. And that's what you got, you know, thanks to Vatican II, you really now have two masters. You have the classical Catholic Church that has always been there and continues to be there as ourselves. And then you've got this brand new Catholic Church that is its own thing. And we of the Church, you know, especially at that point, properly could be said to have been, subsisted in that church. You know, and to some extent, and a growing extent, we also subsist outside. Now, so we're inside, but partially outside and increasingly outside over the years. But what that means is that that explains where we were throughout this period. Now, you could say, well, but Vatican II was already spouting off heresies. How could you even be involved with that? To say nothing of everybody who actually, every prelate of the church who actually signed their names to it. And I borrow from this a piece of history. In Africa, back in about the second or third century, Saint Cyprian had gathered all the bishops of Africa. They had a council. And one of the conclusions of that council, which they agreed upon and which he led them all into, was a notion that a baptism performed by a heretic is, by its very nature, invalid, even if done perfectly and correctly in terms of form and matter and so forth. It's not valid if it's a heretic doing that. So, and that was wrong. Now, did they lose their place in the church? Did Saint Cyprian lose his ability to be not only a Catholic in good standing, but furthermore a saint? Obviously not. So you've got these very long, complicated documents of Vatican II that are, you know, lots of flower talk and verbal and blur and whatever, and you never really know what they're saying. But once in a while, you'd get something where it would crystallize for a moment and indicate something that is, you know, something that it's trying to say or do or change or whatever. And this was one of those spots, but you blink and you miss it. Or maybe the most people saw it was another heresy. Well, going back to the illustration of you know, the priests and bishops of England signing a document to the effect that the king shall be our supreme authority. Is that a heresy? Well, if you want to claim that that's the truth for the church, that's a heresy. But if you just want to say, no, we're not saying the church can't have that guy in Rome as their pope. We're just saying we don't have him. Well, then it's not really a heresy per se. It's a pure schism. And I think this could be taken that way too. I believe, this is my theory, that what they did there, you know, buried in all that blather, this was the thing they really wanted to get at. This was the thing that started it all, was this phrase of disidentifying the historic church with their society. Once they're not equal to each other, because they said subsists in. Now, I venture, they could have said, suppose they'd said subsists as. That would have been a whole different thing. That would have been as good as saying, you know, the all of this church is the mystical body of Christ, which is what Mystici Corporis teaches. So subsists as would have been the correct phrase. By going in, it's clear that they mean to make the relationship very loose and shaky and in fact, explicitly disidentified insofar as you can have something of the church that truly is a means of sanctification and of truth, sources of these things, infallible truth, while not answerable de jure to the Vatican organization. That's what they're really saying. So once you've got that, you've got basically what could be called a Roman schism. Now, I'm not the only one to make this observation, and indeed, that's one of the next things I do after going through the whole passage here in detail. There's several places I quote. All right. I'll just read a little bit from here. It says, the Reverend Luigi Villa, Ph.D., mentions that Hans Kuhn, quote, affirmed that after such a constitution, the Catholic Church, quote, simply does not identify with the Church of Christ, unquote, as there was on this point, quote, a specific revision, unquote, by the Council. This is in his book, Vatican II, About Faith, page 177. So, in other words, the promulgation of this document itself has brought about this specific revision that it specifies. Leonard Boff also similarly observed this grammatical fact and exploited it to his own nefarious purposes, namely to equate one or the other of the now two distinct realities with his favorite communist groups in Latin America. Father Yves Conger wrote in the Council of the Vatican II, page 160, the problem remains if Lumen Gentium strictly and exclusively identifies the mystical body of Christ with the Catholic Church, as did Pius XII in Mystici Corporis, and for that matter, in every reference to the topic in all official church teachings and documents from that beginning, that's my little side note, can we not call it into doubt when we observe that not only is the attribute Roman missing, but also that one avoids saying that only Catholics are members of the mystical body. Thus, they are telling us in Gaudium et Spes, as in a later document of that, that the Church of Christ and the apostles subsisted in is found in the Catholic Church. There is consequently no strict identification, that is exclusive, between the Church of Christ and the Roman Church. Vatican II, in general, especially in these other later documents, admits fundamentally that non-Catholic Christians are members of the mystical body and not merely ordered to it. Okay, now I have another one here. Saint Father Francis Sullivan. He has a book about salvation outside the church, tracing the history of the Catholic response. Although his was primarily addressing the question of Father Feeney, but he reaches an interesting point where he has the following. He's talking about Lumen Gentium, first how it was as a draft internal to the council in 1963, and then how, you know, right after that and going on into 1964, it received a number of revisions before being promulgated in 1964 in the form we have today in the official promulgated documents of Vatican II. So this is what he has to say. This 1963 draft of the conciliar text on the church met with general approval, but received a great number of proposals for emendation. During the interval before the next period of the council, a considerable revision was made in the light of those proposals. And when the bishops gathered in the fall of 1964, they were working with a large volume entitled Schema Constitutionis de Ecclesia, which contained the 1963 draft and the revised text, along with the reports Relationis of the Theological Commission, explaining reasons for each change that had been made in the text. During the 1964 period, the council voted on its final approval of the revised text, with the result that on November 21, Pope Paul VI was able to promulgate the dogmatic constitution on the church known as Lumen Gentium. On that same date, afterwards, however, I point out, Paul VI also promulgated the conciliar decree on ecumenism, Unitatis Redemptor Gratio. With the promulgation of those two conciliar texts, an extraordinary change took place in official Catholic doctrine about the salvation of non-Catholic Christians. Up until, and maybe including, the 1963 draft, as we have seen, the official doctrine was that since there is only one Church of Christ, which is exclusively identified with the Roman Catholic Church, it follows that the Catholic Church is the only ecclesial means of salvation, and that, therefore, salvation for other Christians must also come through the Catholic Church, by virtue of their implicit desire to belong to it. The recognition, both in Lumen Gentium and in the decree on ecumenism, of the ecclesial value of the other Christian churches and communities introduced a profound change in our understanding of the way that other Christians reach salvation. This change is so significant that, in my opinion, no salvation outside the church is no longer a problem for Catholic theology. Not that it ever really was. For as far as the members of the other Christian churches are concerned, in the light of Vatican II, especially as expanded in other documents, starting with Unitatis Redemptor Gratio, we can now recognize their own churches as the ecclesial means by which non-Catholic Christians are being saved. I mean, look at that transition right there.
Wow.
That, yeah. Now, he had a little bit more, and I bring this out somewhat later on in the book. Let's see here. And this gets even closer to all of this. And we're actually getting to the exact moment that this phrase found its way into this document that's supposed to be a constitution of the church. So, now, Francis Sullivan is recounting some details, and I have a source here, Theological Studies 67 from the year 2006, Questio Disputata, or Disputed Questions, a response to Carl Becker, S.J., on the meaning of subsisted in, pages 399 to 402. This is kind of long, but when we get through this, you're going to realize, oh my goodness. I only found this fairly recently as I was putting together this book. But take a look at this. Okay. Becker's next argument is based on a fact that he discovered in the Vatican archives. It was Father Sebastian Tromp, S.J., consultor of the Holy Office and secretary of the Conciliar Doctrinal Commission, a man who had played a major role in drafting both Mystici Corporis and the 1962 Schema on the Church, which is to say an earlier form of Lumen Gentium that didn't have this subsisted in thing. Who suggested using subsistence in to express the relationship between the Church of Christ and the Catholic Church. Becker says, from the very beginning, Sebastian Tromp had defended the full identity of the Church of Christ with the Catholic Church, maintaining and reinforcing this conviction in the conciliar schemas. It is unthinkable that, at the last moment, he changed his mind. I'm sure that anyone who knew Tromp as a colleague, as I myself did, would agree that he would not have changed his mind about the total identity between the Church of Christ and the Catholic Church. The question, however, is whether the doctrinal commission that accepted his suggestion and the council that approved the change from est is to subsist in, understood it to mean what Tromp insisted it had to mean. Fortunately, Becker gives us the exact words that Tromp used in making his suggestion. So we know what he had in mind. Here's how Becker describes the way in which the change took place. After the close of the conciliar discussion of the 1963 draft, so they already had a 63 draft, that was the 63 draft that Sullivan had referred to, okay, a subcommission was appointed for its revision. Its chairman was Gerard Phillips, who had drafted this text, as they say, the text of the revisions. A month later, November 26, 1963, Phillips presented the revised text to the full doctrinal commission. In this text, the phrase Est Ecclesia Catholica, is the Catholic Church, and it's all capitalized, I note, had been changed to Adest in Ecclesia Catholica. Now, this is adest, not subsist. In fact, they actually have three different words they were suggesting. Adest, which just means is present, okay, and another one was inventature, which is found in, as well as finally the subsists. They would say adest in, or inventature in, or subsists in. All three of those really, though, have in common in instead of as. So, okay. In this phrase, in this text, the phrase est Ecclesia Catholica had been changed to adest in Ecclesia Catholica. Phillips explained that this change was made because it had been proposed in the council and because it could then better be said that there are elements present elsewhere. As Becker points out, no one in the conciliar discussion had proposed the change from est to adest in. But as we have seen, Bishop Van Dodewaert had proposed the change to inventure in, and there is good evidence that Phillips and his subcommission saw those terms as equivalent. This is clear from the official relatio explaining the revised draft, which used adest in and inventure in as synonyms. We now come to Tromp's intervention, about which Becker provides information from a tape recording kept in the Vatican archives of the discussion that took place in the plenary session of the Doctrinal Commission, at which Phillips presented the revised draft with adest in. Here about Schauff, a member of the Doctrinal Commission, objected to adest in on the grounds that it was imprecise. Becker then quotes Tromp as saying, possessus dicere itaque subsistit in Ecclesia Catholica et hoc est exclusivum. So he said that last very, very forcefully. You know, in quantum dicitur alibi non sunt nisi elementa explicatur in textu. We can figure out that. Okay. We know, therefore, that it was Tromp who had suggested the term subsistit in, but also that we know that he strongly insisted it meant that the Church of Christ subsists exclusively in, or in other words, as, the Catholic Church, and that outside it, there are only elements. Obviously, this meant that outside the Catholic Church, there is nothing that can be called a church in the proper sense of the word. For Trump, there was no yielding on that station in the statement in the 1962 draft, only the one that is Roman Catholic is rightly called church. But it turns out, I'm going to have to kind of summarize here, but there's a little part here that gets, I'm going to skip down here. So the relatio for this text shows that the Doctrinal Commission realized that this language, of which Tromp could hardly have approved, needed to be justified. It said that the elements that are mentioned regard not only individuals, but communities, precisely in this fact, is located, and note this, the foundation of the ecumenical movement. Now let those words sink in. Hmm. Now, why should we Protestantize our Mass? To get warm and fuzzy and ecumenical with our Protestants. Why should we talk about religious liberty? Because we want to grant that Protestants have truths too that everyone should be listening to. Everything about Vatican II could be traced to this whole ecumenical thing, which right there they acknowledge came from that exact moment.
Interesting.
Yeah. So anyway, when you've got this lack of identity between the two societies, a number of interesting things happen. The most important one, relevant to our set of Acantus discussions here, is this. It means that the guy who runs the Vatican organization, even if you want to call him Pope, you know, you might as well call him, you know, First Citizen or Grand Poobah, really. It's not Pope in the Catholic meaning of that word anymore. He's just a guy running a group of people, you know, some of whom would be happen to be Catholic, but not necessarily all. He not only didn't say subsist as, he didn't even say subsist throughout, you know, this Catholic Church, just merely in. You know, you could say that the Catholic Church, properly speaking, subsists in, and I'll just pick at random, the United States of America, the secular nation. And, you know, does it? Well, Catholics are here. Catholics are part of it. Catholics are citizens of this particular nation or any other nation you care to name. So you can properly say the church subsists in every nation of the world and in every age, you know, from the time of Christ till the end of the world, you see. But imagine the blasphemy of saying that the Catholic Church subsists as the United States. That would be insane. That would be stupid. That's, you see, when you say as, you are talking direct, total, absolute identification. Or, as Trump put it, subsists in and is exclusive is the same thing. You know, it would be to say that this country is the church. Every citizen is therefore a Catholic. Every non-citizen is outside the church. Well, then, you know, we all perfectly ridiculous that would be, but that's what it is. You see, the church can subsist in various secular nations and times and places and whatnot, but it has to subsist as, you know, the society led by the real successor of Peter under real bishops and real priests and hierarchy and all the rest of it. When you don't have identity, what it means is that at least something of the church is not under his jurisdiction. Something of the mystical body of Christ, the visible, canonical, lawful body of Christ in this world is not subject to, at this time, Mr. Bergoglio. Why? Because because something of the church, and not just mere elements, but actually the means of sanctification and of truth, the source of sanctification and truth, is beyond the confines, is outside. It is part of the church over which he has no jurisdiction nor authority over, per their own definition. They said it. This isn't me trying to, you know, usurp something or yank something out of their hands. They relinquished it. They threw it in the trash. All I did is look in their trash can and, oh, look at this. You know, they threw it away. They said their authority is not universal. And when that happens, what you have is not a pope. At that moment, whatever he may or may not have been along the lines of, was he a bad pope, a non-pope, a material pope, all kinds of ideas can be legitimately ventured. You know, when he signed that and promulgated that, his jurisdiction ceased to be universal. And at that point, his rank, you know, apart from any heresy associated with all of this, mind you, that could put him out of the church, but it's just apart from that, is automatically on par with that of, say, some particular archbishop, or maybe, to get it a little closer, let's say, a patriarch of some particular other rite. You have a jurisdiction over some people, and a rite could even be an operative in many parts of the world, you see, even coextensive with the Latin rite. But you don't have the whole church. What does it mean? It means you cannot define doctrine for the whole church, only for your particular flock, be it a particular rite or an archdiocese or even just an ordinary diocese of an ordinary bishop. You can define something for your flock. That's it. You know, not counting when you're in council and everybody together is doing something, including the Pope. But when you're just acting, you only define by yourself. Well, when you have that, infallibility doesn't apply. What does it take for something to be infallible? It has to be about faith and morals, and it has to be a very solemn definition, and it has to apply to all Catholics everywhere. Only the Pope, whether alone or in ecumenical council, has the authority to impose some particular dogmatic finding on the whole church.
You know, and that would be an argument that they would, right, that okay. Lumen Gentium and the Second Vatican Council, it's just pastoral. It's not, there's nothing binding. It's not infallible, right? I think that's one of the primary arguments I see them bring up, that it's like, yeah, it was done by bad men, but it doesn't matter because it's not infallible.
Well, I didn't say it was infallible. In fact, it actually is rather fallible, all said and told, which was, that gets into a side issue not worth bringing up at this point, but it is fallible. I mean, how fallible was the Patriarch of Constantinople's excommunication of the Pope? Well, you could say you infallibly, quote unquote, created an excommunication, but it was very fallible in that it wasn't the Pope, but the man himself who was excommunicated by that. Or again, the British schism, you know, was that infallible? Well, you could call it that in the sense that it acknowledged the ability that the, you know, however implicitly, and maybe not even explicitly, but just implicitly, that it was okay for the Pope to be, you know, of Rome to be over all the other Christians of the world, but not over us, you see. But it also kind of sounds like a heresy in a way, because it's claiming that his authority, the Pope's authority, shouldn't be over us or something, you see. So you could take it in a heretical sense. So that to me sounds very fallible. So, you know, Lumen Gentium, I think, is a very fallible document, but it doesn't have to be a dogmatic truth of the church. All it had to do is something that expresses a legal change. You want to call something pastoral? You set a policy that says priests shall require their parishioners to tell everybody to fast on Tuesdays. That's a pastoral direction. So, you know, but you could pass it like a law. You could enshrine it as canon number such and such in a revised code of canon law if you wanted, you see. That's a little more, you know, it may not exactly acquire the status of doctrine or dogma, but it does set up a change in the legal relationship. Just as those other breaks changed the legal relationship, this document changed the legal relationship between one society and the church, where before there was identity, now there's an explicit disidentification. So where there's a disidentification, they, as a society, cease to be the church, have cut themselves off from the church, and therefore go on to experience now, actually quite predictably and reasonably, all the decay and decadence as we've seen. You expect that now. And basically anybody reading then, if they had, you know, a brain and thought this through, should have been able to anticipate exactly that result. It could have been anticipated just looking at the statement itself in isolation of all the history that followed from it. So that's kind of the main thing. So now we have another reason, and more interestingly, a more important reason to say that the Vatican leadership is not papal, because it is now, by their own admission, by upholding Vatican II, their jurisdiction is not universal.
Right.
So there it is. It's not universal. You see, we are Catholics, but we are not subject to the man de jure in any way, shape, or form. You know, even if he weren't a heretic, he'd still be like the archbishop of some neighboring archdiocese, not our archbishop. But he's also, having cut himself off from the church, he's also gone into all the heresies we've all observed, and so on. So that, in a nutshell, is the key part of it. Now, there's more stuff I get into. You know, at the end of Volume 1, I said there were 22 questions unresolved. Of those 22 questions, I am able to resolve 14 of them on the basic and most essential parts of the theory. After that, well, let me just give a quick guide to what's in the second volume of this book. I've talked about the appendix a lot as far as comparing, you know, some of the different ideas that people have come up with. But let me just give the framework here. So chapter one was the statement, the basic statement of the theory itself, a close, tight analysis of the actual phraseology used in the text of Lumen Gentium, and also how, you know, not only I, but other readers have seen what it says. Okay, then the theory applied to the papacy. Well, I actually just gave that one by showing he doesn't have universal jurisdiction. He cannot be pope. Okay, the theory is applied to the remainder of the council. What does that mean for the rest of Vatican II? it doesn't have a pope presiding. Ergo, it is an imperfect council. See, all this follows very, very directly, logically, like theorems, proving other theorems, proving other theorems. If this is true, and it obviously A is true, and B implies this other thing is true, and if this is true, things could happen, which in fact have happened, that would only be possible if this or something like it is in fact the truth. Okay, continuing on here. Episcopal succession in Lumen Gentium. I think there's still room to allow for the possibility that even as the document is in effect legally cutting things off, cutting a whole society off from the church, you know, especially here in this peculiar way where not everybody in that society is put out of the church. Only a new society is created, a new overlapping society, mind you, is created in parallel to the church. And then this overlap can, you know, by express description, change and decrease over time as more of the church is found having to continue outside their society, as, you know, most obviously traditional Catholics are forced to do today. So that now gets, what's the next part? And then also Episcopal collegiality. Now, this is also of some interest. Oh, gosh, I don't know if I want to bring that up. That could be a good topic for a future segment. But anyway, that could be in there, too. My suggestion is that it might be. So after that, we get into more. Okay, we discussed that. So first, now the next one, chapter 6, how the theory addresses questions from part 1. As I said, 14 of the 22 dangling questions can actually be addressed by just that much and definitively answered. There's still another 8 questions that get more speculative, and we'll get back to those a little later. And then chapter 7, considerations, questions, and objections to the theory. So we ask these questions. Is Lumen Gentium's subsistence statement a heresy? See, people usually just dismiss it as a heresy. You know, well, saying that the king is our pope could be taken as a heresy or not. And I think what's in Lumen Gentium is the same way. You could just take it as just another one of how many heresies that have already happened and continue to happen. Or you could say this is the exact juncture that something societal, organizational, canonical took place that redefined the nature of that society, making it possible for it to do the things we saw since. There were things a little bit before that were bad and questionable, but I don't know that there's anything before that point that is absolutely categorically impossible to the church. Some things come close. That would have to be evaluated. But that's an interesting thought. Okay. B, what about other errors and heresies contained in Lumen Gentium? Well, I'm not claiming that it's perfect. In there, there's a rather interesting quote from Charles Journet that talks about this sort of thing, which I don't know. It's kind of interesting. All right. See, does Lumen Gentium really intend to extend jurisdiction? And I show, yes, it does. Okay, D, did Vatican II happen all at once? Now, what this is that some people seem to think that none of its provisions took force until at the very, very, very end and the closing ceremonies are finishing up. They promulgated one more thing that says, okay, we are done with this council, basically. And supposedly everything went into effect at that time. No, it didn't. Each document went into effect the moment it was promulgated. We know this because in the 1963 sessions where they had this document that said we're going to set up a commission to revise the liturgy, that commission did not have to wait until December of 1965 to begin convening and starting their thing. They hit the ground running right away in 1963. So these things were operative in their moment. So that's kind of that question. All right, here's another one. Would that mean that the true church spawned a false church? I talk about that scenario. Somebody said, well, you're claiming the true church spawned a false church, only in the same sense that it has always been possible for some society created by the church, say a religious order, to separate itself from the church and go off and wig out into strange worlds. You know, that doesn't mean the church created. It's like saying you might as well blame God for making a man who chooses to fall into sin. You know, did God make Adam sin? Did God create a sinner as a sinner? No. So it kind of compares to that. Is this theory a novelty? To some extent, the situation is kind of a novelty. So to that extent, obviously you have to explain it. But is it novelty in the context of doctrine? I don't think so. If someone can show me otherwise, that would certainly be of interest. But until then, I don't think people have business saying, oh, what you got is a heresy. You know, really, really show me what doctrine I have contradicted in all of this. You know, then maybe we can talk about that. All right. What about denials that Lumen Gentium changed anything? Well, actually, what I read, the longer quote about how this was the start of the ecumenical movement, was part of that answer there. Chapter 8, considerations. What if the theory isn't true? It is, after all, a theory. And to be careful and cautious and responsible as anyone should be as a serious academic in venturing a theory, you still have to consider, what if it isn't true? What if it, you know, it's a great idea, it sure looks pretty good, but let's say somehow it's some kind of colossal mistake. Is it worthless? Has it taught us nothing? Is it, you know, just trash the whole thing? I don't think that's the case. I think there's still some definite benefit from this. Okay. Number 9, summary, basic claims of the theory. Okay. And then, so I'm kind of summarizing what we've got, the basic claims. And that's enough to answer and address, like I said, 14 of the 22 questions that were left from volume 1. Now, 10, we get into what I call further hypothetical ideas suggested by the theory. There is definitely room for what I'm saying in chapter 10 to be, it's very speculative. It is to a much more significant degree of a framework of guesses and so forth. It could be more seriously in need of correction. I accept that from the get-go. But it does kind of produce abilities to answer the remaining 8 questions of the 22 left over from part 1. So at least it provides an answer. Whether it's the answer is another question, but it is at least an answer. Then you get down to chapter 11, putting together the full canonical sequence. So now that we have a theory, we can show what this theory shows us about where the church was at every stage of its succession from one point to the other. We can show the true succession. And this really shows us a lot more, also about the source of our authority. But let's go on about that. Then as a conclusion, some last questions. And actually, there are also 4 additional questions from part 1 that couldn't be addressed there. And they really can't be solved here either. I talk about those a little bit more. There's legitimate reasons. One was, will there be miracles to support, you know, that we're the church and not them? You know, well, without the appropriate people to and or processes to judge miracles, you know, we haven't put one together. The Novus Ordo one is obviously not trustworthy. You know, we don't have that. What will the answer be when something like that exists? Obviously, that's a kind of question worth asking, but it's outside the scope of this nature of study. And the same goes for the other 3 dangling questions that still dangle at the end of this. Okay. But you understand where this is at and why basically it's not the place of the study to even attempt an answer beyond what very basic discussion I can venture here. And then finally, we launched into the tables about all the various different, the 23 different scenarios that Catholics have come up with, which we've already talked about before. So that is the structure of the book. Now, about jurisdiction, this gets to something else. I think what happened was this. It was like we were in a burning house, and we grabbed weather and jumped out the window to get out of the house as quickly as possible. I remember as a kid wondering, if the house is on fire, what would I do? You know, and I couldn't even get to the door or the room or whatever. I'd probably grab, guess what, my pillow and jump out the window. Why my pillow? That's a stupid thing. What do I care about a pillow? You know, I mean, I can buy one at a department store for a few dollars, you know, right? But I kind of realized just in my own introspection, that's the kind of irrational thing people often do in fires when they don't have time to do anything useful or responsible. They'll grab onto some random object like a pillow or whatever and just go out with that. And I kind of feel like maybe it's like Catholics were in this burning house of the Vatican organization and we had to get out and we took whatever few things we thought of. Well, let's see. Oh, One thing we've got to make sure we bring is valid orders. Let's make sure we have some bishops with us. So eventually, you know, Providence has given us some bishops. Okay. And then later on, somebody said, well, what about authority? And I think it was like they kind of said, we didn't think about that, you know? And then they start scrapping and scrounging for authority as if it's just something, you know, but we're the church. Once you understand that, God protects his church. God is with his church. And even if we didn't think of it, God did. And so the theory also shows and explains exactly, you know, how that authority comes, you know, to our bishops as bishops. And it doesn't even have to be territorial. As long as a bishop has an identifiable flock, that is his, you know, at least an ecclesial district tantamount to a diocese is the exact canonical phrase. And that's, you know, and so that's how that really works. Authority isn't something we got to scrab about for and start inventing things about, well, maybe supplied jurisdiction. Yeah, that exists and, you know, has a role, but it's not the only reason that Catholic bishops and priests are able to do what they need to do to sustain the church. You know, an epikeia, you know, canon 22, you know, 16, I think it is, or whatever the number is, you know, and all these different kinds of things you could cite. You know, these are just kind of living on the fringes. It's like we're the puppy dogs, you know, begging for scraps off the table, when in fact, we're the ones seated at the table. The Novus Ordo can have our table scraps if they're interested, which, you know, by and large, they are not. Certainly not anymore. Maybe for a while in the beginning they might have been, but I don't know.
Good stuff. Mr. Griff Ruby, I really appreciate it. I've appreciated all these shows. I hope to have you on again. I'm going to have you on just for a question and answer one. We didn't get to them this time, really, but I do have people who do have questions. I think you answered a lot of them actually already, that you went into much better detail into your theory, which people had asked for. So that will help. And if people have questions, please write me on Twitter. You can find me on Twitter at Kevy Gillikin. You can write me an email.
I don't know how to maneuver.
Email
or the messenger, because I'm not very good at Twitter. But as far as questions, I'd be a great idea for a second sprint session. And maybe if there's not too many, I'm thinking a good thing to do would be to go back to volume one and have a series based on the various chapters one by one. Read what's in there. Read what we discover. Read what we can deduce. And build it all layer by layer by layer. What do I know and how do I know it? I think that could be something worth doing, and that could give us, you know, a good series to move on into. Something to look forward to.
Something to look forward to. Perfect. Mr. Ruby, I appreciate it. Anyone who would like this show, please, on YouTube, like, share, and subscribe. Comment. Comments also help YouTube give us a little bit of love and appreciation so we get more likes and views. And share truth and share good topics, good discussions. We're not always talking about these deep theological issues. Sometimes we do. Sometimes we talk about moral, societal issues. So please stick around for those. And as Griff said earlier, we talked to a lady in Canada about her conversion story. So we talk about all sorts of different things. So please, again, subscribe to the channel, share this video with your family and friends. We'll hopefully won't confuse you too much. And really, I mean, the book and this whole topic, it's a theory, but it is giving a possible answer to a bunch of big problems that we have. And I really appreciate that. So, Mr. Ruby, until next time, thank you very much.
Okay, then.
God bless you.
Thank you.